Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. Coming up on this week's episode, McKenna Langley, our associate producer, and I will be joined by Tom McGee, the CEO and president of ICSC. We'll talk about their upcoming event in Las Vegas and key themes surrounding retail real estate in 2022 and really where those conversations are headed as the year progresses. In news, we'll talk about a number of stories, three different smaller stories involving three different sectors of retail. A quick reminder that you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. Also, if you enjoy the show, please feel free to subscribe. Also, give us a rating. Those ratings help other retail-minded individuals to find the show and check us out. So we do appreciate all of those ratings out there. So as we mentioned, no major stories this week, no big earnings calls. So we're going to tackle a few smaller ones today, three in total, two in our first news segment, and then one in our looking ahead segment. And first, we turn to BJ's as they unveil their new small format store concept. The store, called BJ's Market, is around 43,000 square feet and is one of three scheduled to be built and opened in the near future. This location is in Warwick, New Jersey, with others, of course, in the pipeline. The idea behind these locations is kind of to attempt to attract shoppers with a selection of some of those higher volume products that BJ's moves. Especially, you're looking around consumables here, whether that's in produce, whether that's in food, or whether that's in household consumables. One of the persisting aspects generally around club or warehouse retail is the fact that often a trip can take you hours, and it's rarely an in-and-out event. Anyone who's ever navigated a Costco parking lot can certainly attest to this. It took me about 10 minutes to even get to the Costco parking lot on a recent trip. But BJ's here attempts to kind of streamline that customer experience. They want to make it more convenient to pick up essentials. And in so doing, they want to attract new members and maybe strengthen those existing member connections. In addition to groceries and household consumables, they'll include seasonal in the mix as well. Package sizes, by the way, will not scale down to the store size, so you're not looking at maybe something that is more befitting a smaller grocery store. So those same package sizes you can get at a BJ's Wholesale Club originally will persist in these smaller locations. These smaller format stores were previously announced in their earnings call on March 3rd, but the opening took place officially this past week. And since it is their first location that is smaller format, they'll be using this kind of as a live retail lab, testing various things for the purpose of not only their future small format locations or what are hoped to be future small format locations if this takes off, but also testing some ideas that might take on in their main clubs as well. And they've got a lot of club openings in the pipeline for the near future. Remember, BJ's is a chain with a little over 200 stores overall. They have 11 openings scheduled for this year, so you're looking at about a 5% increase in terms of store footprint. So something tests well in the BJ's Market. You could very much see it implemented in future construction plans for their new locations, and really something that they've been working on since they went public, since they issued their IPO, is building out their store base, expanding to new markets, and they're scheduled to expand to around 5 to 6 new markets this year. Now, as far as those that might be living near this BJ's Market store, they're trying to incentivize signing up for a new membership at the smaller format location. Again, you're looking at kind of an appeal to a new customer base, maybe a customer base that doesn't want to go to those larger stores. As a result, they're running a promotion where through May 5th, anyone who becomes a member for the first time at BJ's, at the BJ's Market specifically, will get a $25 Inner Circle membership. Usually this runs $55 if you just purchase it straight away. Or you can get a $65 BJ's Perks Rewards membership. This is usually $110. So once again, this speaks to the fact that they are trying to kind of appeal to a new customer base, maybe a customer base that wasn't willing to go to their larger square footage stores, but wouldn't mind heading to a 43,000 square foot store, get in and out quickly with some of those larger package sizes. We've talked about larger package sizes becoming a bit more of a thing during the pandemic. Obviously, it'll be interesting to see how the landscape of food inflation and consumables inflation changes this or adjusts this, if at all, in the new future. But this pilot does raise some interesting questions about the future of membership club retail. For one, the cost traditionally to open a new store to this point in membership club or wholesale retail is somewhat prohibitive. The cost of commercial land in high traffic areas, building costs, construction costs, all going up, whether it's raw materials, whether it's the land itself. And of course, more land is required for one of these membership clubs than would be required for a lot of ordinary retail. And so obviously these clubs are going to take a second and third and fourth look to ensure that every club that they open up is going to be worth the initial outlay, which again can run very high for a traditional store. So if a 43,000 square foot location proves effective, especially on the cost front, it might give BJ's a chance for further expansion into markets where a 100,000 square foot store or more isn't feasible. If a lot of land is already taken up, if maybe not a lot of land is already available in those high traffic areas, you can squeeze in that 43,000 square foot store plus or minus 10,000 square feet. And of course, retail is a copycat business. So if the model works for BJ's, perhaps it's something that you see Sam's Club or maybe more importantly, Costco attempt. And I know from Costco's perspective, at least, there's a lot to be said for the overall feel of the clubs to customers. You know, Costco prides themselves on the overall experience their members get in their warehouses. You can just look at their cult following regarding their in-store food as an example. Everyone loves the hot dogs and pizza at Costco. I'm not entirely sure why, but that is certainly part and parcel of the whole experience regarding these clubs. So maybe that's watered down a little bit with the 43,000 square foot locations. Maybe you see kind of a streamlining of operations there where you don't have those extra services like optical or automotive. And if BJ's can find a way to both build a new customer base and underscore, and this is key, a convenience proposition to their customers, and that's something, convenience, that's been missing from club and warehouse retail in general, I think this could signal a beginning of a shift in approach. And it's something to watch out for, particularly from the shopping center and retail district point of view. These are, of course, traffic drivers. And so if you have a retail center, if you have a shopping district, if you can draw in maybe a 45,000 square foot BJ's, that is going to be a positive for everyone that's in that center. And it could also be a positive for BJ's, who then doesn't need to undertake the capital outlay to construct a larger square foot store, or maybe if they're renting, don't need the outlay to rent the larger square foot store. So again, something to keep an eye on as far as warehouse retail is concerned, and we'll be looking forward to BJ's future earnings calls where they provide more color on how this first location is doing. Next up in news, Family Dollar is in the news for all the wrong reasons as the Arkansas State Attorney General files a lawsuit, or if you live in Kansas, I guess it would be the Arkansas State Attorney General, but you'll recall that we've discussed several Family Dollar stores in Arkansas and surrounding areas, in fact over 400 at all, having to close for as many as 2 weeks earlier this year due to a rodent issue at a West Memphis distribution center in Arkansas. Now, the Attorney General in Arkansas is claiming that Family Dollar knew of the infestation well prior to closing the stores and correcting things at the distribution center, basically alleging that they looked the other way or didn't put enough corrective measures in place. The story was reported in the New York Times, and it also alleges that Family Dollar continued to ship out and sell products that may have been potentially contaminated by these rodents to customers for potentially as long as 2 years. A further look at the FDA report, of course, from earlier this year indicates that Family Dollar may have been aware of the rodent issue at this particular distribution center as early as January 2020. And in fact, between March and September of 2021, over 2,300 rodents had been collected at this particular West Memphis distribution center. And then after fumigation during this January, over 1,100 dead rodents were found. Really, the report is we're not going to get into it here necessarily on the podcast. I want everyone to keep their lunch safely within them, but it is rather unsettling, some of the details in this FDA report. But the bigger issue maybe is that the FDA also claimed that the system to track potentially contaminated products from this distribution center was non-existent. And I don't think this is surprising to anyone who's been in a Dollar Tree or a Family Dollar lately and seen the massive amount of product lying in boxes on the floor or in back rooms. Analysts have claimed for some time, in fact, that their inventory tracking is suspect due to these store-level issues, but you just get a feel like maybe they don't have their finger on the pulse of their inventory like they should. And I don't think anyone would argue with the fact that their inventory tracking system from DC to store probably isn't catching all inventory that's there, or probably at least isn't tracking all inventory in such a way that would enable them to recall the products accurately. They did issue a voluntary recall of any products purchased at these stores that may have been affected by the rodent issues. But basically, it all comes back to the fact that the base of this lawsuit is that Family Dollar knew of the issues here, didn't take extensive enough corrective action, and therefore sold products, again, the lawsuit alleges willingly, to customers that may have been contaminated by the rodents. The suit is seeking up to $10,000 for each violation of Arkansas's Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and it's also seeking to revoke the company's authorization to conduct business in Arkansas. The latter would be a major blow, of course. You look at Family Dollar, they have a significant presence in Arkansas, and of course, this particular distribution center that is providing retail jobs and stocking as many as 400 Family Dollar stores from the distribution center. So the big question is, will other states follow? Of course, this distribution center distributes to other areas outside of Arkansas. Bigger picture for Family Dollar, if they can navigate this with only a financial penalty, that's the ideal for them. Being unable to do business in a state entirely, as Arkansas is seeking, that would be significant, especially if neighboring states seek similar action. And then there is the question of what becomes of the stores, the real estate and the locations and the employees and the merchandise, all of that, if Family Dollar has to vacate in a worst-case scenario. And any action would widen food deserts in smaller Arkansas towns, a lot of which 800 to 1,000 people are a long distance away from the nearest grocery store. And that's kind of why the idea of the Attorney General closing the stores entirely seems a bit unlikely. The Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge was in fact quoted in the New York Times story as saying, and I'll quote here, "We don't want to wipe out a source of groceries and medicines, but if those groceries and medicines are not safe, we need someone else providing that service," end quote. I think overall, as with most of these cases, you're likely to see something settled, and I don't think that it's a really imminent possibility that Family Dollar will be forced to close their stores in Arkansas on a permanent basis due to losing their license to do business in the state. But I do think this will be financially costly for Family Dollar, and I also think that this should be a wake-up call for other retailers that might be having issues in distribution centers. If you've ever been to a retail distribution center, they are very large. They're basically these enormous warehouses, and you could certainly see how a small rodent problem might persist, but a rodent problem of this magnitude, that's something that usually only comes into play after some sort of negligence on the part of the company. So you have to wonder how many other retailers are seeing this and saying, okay, we've got to go back, fumigate those DCs, and take care of any potential issues, because it wouldn't surprise me that some of these issues have fallen through the cracks at other retailers and maybe other retailers in the same sector overall. So something certainly to watch for as far as Family Dollar is concerned. At the very least, you're going to see a financial penalty, fairly certain from this, but maybe not. Maybe they can slip away from it. I think the financial penalty, though, is probably the most likely outcome in the form of a settlement, just as an onlooker from the outside in. So that'll do it for our first news segment. Coming up after this, associate producer McKenna Langley with part of a voice. As you should mention, she was kind of losing her voice as we recorded the interview. And I will be joined by Tom McGee, the CEO and president of ICSC. We'll talk about the upcoming ICSC event in Las Vegas that's taking place just a few weeks from now, later this month in May. And we'll also talk about prominent discussions being had currently on the retail real estate front and certain things that shopping centers are keeping an eye on in the year 2022 going forward. When it comes to brick and mortar real estate, lots of very absolute language has been tossed around over the last few years, but the reality is the landscape today is more nuanced and complex than it has ever been, leaving landlords and retailers alike to charter unexplored waters. Fortunately for everyone in the retail and real estate community, ICSC is back this year in Las Vegas, and so people from all across retail will meet at the largest industry event to discuss what brick and mortar retail does look like in 2022 and what it'll look like in years beyond. And here to discuss the event and some of the major topics of conversation going in is Tom McGee, CEO of ICSC. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Trent. Great to be with you.
First, could you give our listeners a brief overview of the scope of ICSC's day-to-day operations there?
Sure. ICSC represents the marketplace industry. The marketplace industry is where people gather to shop, work, play, dine, etc. We have about 50,000 members here in North America and additional couple thousand throughout the world. And we represent anyone that has anything to do with retail, both shopping center developers and owners, tenants, service providers, attorneys, banks and financial institutions. We're really the place that people come together to talk about and to network associated with this industry. We provide advocacy services, a lot of media representation for the industry, education and professional development, and importantly, networking and deal making. ICSC is well known as the place that people come to meet others interested in the industry and to network and to do deals, which is a big part of what our upcoming event in Las Vegas will be all about.
Perfect. Thank you, Tom, which that actually brings us to our next question. So ICSC holds many events, but the annual large events in Las Vegas is obviously the chief among them. For someone that's never been, how would you describe ICSC in Las Vegas?
First of all, I would describe it as big. So make sure that if it's your first time coming to the event, bring some comfortable shoes to walk around and meet, you know, 20,000 plus people that will gather in Las Vegas. The basic value proposition and this most fundamental level of ICSC Las Vegas is we bring everyone together under one roof to really talk about the industry, talk about trends, challenges, opportunities, et cetera, but principally to network and to deal make. And we take over the entire Las Vegas Convention Center. Many of our members set up large meeting spaces where they bring other folks in and talk about different deal making opportunities, whether that's new development that's taking place, whether that's new space that they're looking to lease, whether that's the extension of an existing lease, whether that's financing transactions. It'll be a full 2 days of people doing networking and deal making. And then around that, we have a whole array of different educational and topic related items that people can come together and listen to others in the industry share their perspectives around the industry and the economy in general and business trends in general. This is the first time we'll be together in 3 years in this format. We had a smaller event in Las Vegas in December called Here We Go, but this is our crown jewel event. And we have not been together at this time of the year, which we annually hold at the third week of May since May of 2019 because of the pandemic. And so there'll be a lot of excitement with people being back together again as well. And there is a lot of enthusiasm right now in the industry. The industry is very active. and has emerged from the pandemic in a strong position.
And we'll talk about some of those main themes here in just a moment. But first, I wanted to ask a non-retail question of you, because you mentioned this is the first time in 3 years, really the first time since COVID, that such a large in-person event will be hosted by ICSC. What are some of the challenges? What are some of the thought processes behind assembling such an enormous event where you've got 20,000 people from the industry gathering in one place?
It is a big logistical, you know, challenge for sure. And really hats off to our events team who pulls this together. You know, we have a lot of very experienced event professionals. We host, you know, well over 100 events annually, but this, of course, is the largest. And so there's a lot of logistical challenges just in bringing and accumulating that many people together. And of course, building out the exhibition floor. So that's really fundamental to the value proposition of the event. And of course, you have, you know, health and safety precautions and protocols that you want to make sure that you're very attuned to and sensitive to, given, you know, the environment that we've lived through with COVID. And so that's a new perspective that didn't exist 3 years ago. We're also introducing a number of new tools as part of this event. We have a real leading edge app that event attendees will be able to use to navigate the floor and get up-to-date information on everything that's happening throughout the event. But we're also introducing a new networking tool that allows people, attendees in advance of the event, to really network with each other, to find people of like interests. You know, 20,000 people is a lot of people. And quite frankly, it'll be more than 20,000 people that'll be there. And finding people that you want to talk to that have similar interests, that are looking for space that maybe you have available or vice versa. So that networking tool will be, you know, real value added to making people's experience there very beneficial. And the networking tool will also allow people to highlight, you know, properties that they want to focus on, you know, leasing and are showcasing at the event. And of course, this new event, we're introducing in a big way our new brand, ICSC, with our tagline of innovating commerce, serving communities, which is really what our industry is about. And so there'll be a whole new modern look and feel to the event as well. So there's a lot to it, but we're up to the task and we're so excited to welcome everybody back together in this major event again.
Absolutely. And actually kind of diving a little further in on that, what are the main themes surrounding ICSC 2022?
You know, obviously we've lived through 2+ very historic years. And so I think there's a lot of interest in just the trends that took place and really accelerated during the course of the pandemic. So there'll be a lot of conversation around, obviously, the convergence of the physical and digital world, which really is the story of the pandemic, the strength of the industry. I think if you would have closed your eyes back in March of 2020 and said that a pandemic was going to occur that would impact retail and where people come together in physical space very centrally by the nature of it being a pandemic, that you wouldn't have imagined that the industry would have emerged from it in a really strong position. But right now, the demand for physical space has never been stronger. And retailers and consumers have increasingly, you know, understood the value of physical space. And so the level of leasing activity in the industry is super strong right now. And so there'll be a lot of conversation around that. And the use of real estate, though, has changed. You see a lot more click and collect, you know, buy online, pick up in store. And the store layout gets impacted by that. So a lot of conversation about store layout and the use of space. Parking lots and infrastructure around shopping centers get impacted by that. Traffic flow gets impacted by that. So there's going to be a lot of conversation around that as well. And of course, the broader economic environment. We're obviously living in an inflationary environment that didn't exist 3 years ago and really hasn't existed at this level for almost 40 years. And so a lot of conversation around inflation, conversation about rising interest rates, the broader economy, et cetera, will take place. And of course, you know, conversations around ESG, you know, how different companies are leading in that regard. Obviously, real estate, you know, leading in environmentalism is super important. Sustainability is super important in our industry. And then a diversity, equity, and inclusion, that S in ESG is a really, really high in focus along a lot of our members. And so that'll be an increasing source of conversation as well.
I know we want to touch on inflation here in a moment, but first I wanted to ask you, in the intervening time since the last large ICSC event, We've seen a lot of proposed government regulations. I know a lot of commercial real estate investors, particularly those that are involved with retail, are concerned with the future of things like 1031 exchanges, maybe other regulatory barriers that might be put into place. I'm curious, what is ICSC hearing from the real estate community about maybe potential policy changes that are on the horizon and maybe how real estate professionals will react to those changes if necessary?
Well, you mentioned one, 1031 like-kind exchanges that has been included in the administration's budget proposal as some changes in that area that would effectively eliminate the use of 1031. That would be disastrous for the industry, particularly for smaller real estate owners and developers and investors. And so we're actively, along with other real estate organizations, communicating, our lack of support for that and the need for that to go away as something that the president and the administration is proposing. We were successful in garnering support when that was included in the Build Back Better plan and proposal. That was not included in the proposal that the House Ways and Means Committee had, which was, democratically led, was not included in their pay force. And so we're hopeful that that will continue to have congressional support for maintaining 1031 like-kind exchange rules the way they are. Carried interest is also super important in real estate, particularly smaller real estate, privately held real estate developers. It oftentimes gets positioned as something that is related to the hedge fund and private equity industry, but the majority of partnerships in this country are real estate in nature. And most of those partnerships tend to be on the smaller end of the spectrum, and carried interest is an important part of that equation and capital formation and entrepreneurship. And so we're actively lobbying against the proposal to eliminate carried interest. Obviously there's an increasing level of focus upon taxing capital investment similar to ordinary income. And, we think they're fundamentally different. Real estate is a long-term investment, and any changes in raising capital gains rates or taxing unrealized gains is something that, we're not supportive of and will actively advocate against. So there's a lot of things out there that, could impact the industry. So far to date, we've been successful in advocating on behalf of the industry with many of our other real estate and other industry partners, and we'll continue to do so. But we have to be very vigilant in that regard.
As a follow-up question on that, actually, would you mind sharing what it looks like for you guys to actually, lobby and fight those policies a bit?
Sure. We have ICC has a large team of professionals, teammates in Washington, D.C. We have an office in Washington, D.C. And so, a big part of advocating on behalf of the industry is developing relationships with congressional leaders, both in the House and the Senate, and their staff, and making sure that they understand, the importance of the industry, the important role it plays in communities. That's a big part of our industry. Obviously, we tend to be the largest source of tax revenue for virtually every community across our country. Making sure that political leaders understand the importance of the industry and the impact it'll have upon local communities, particularly the tax base in local communities, and by definition and extension, employment, is a big part of our advocacy efforts. We are very much a bipartisan organization, so we engage with both Democratic and Republican members of the House and the Senate and their staff. We're for common sense proposals, and we work with other organizations, obviously other real estate organizations, but we're a consumer-facing industry as well. And so we actively work with retail and other industries that interact with consumers. On that front, one of the other issues that, we're really trying to educate lawmakers on is organized crime and organized retail crime. And obviously there's been an increasing level of retail theft that has occurred over the course of the last number of years. A lot of that is backed by organizations that then turn around and sell that stolen product online. And, that needs to stop. And so we're educating national leaders on the need to support local leaders in enforcing existing laws to make sure that people that commit those crimes are properly, prosecuted. It's not just big retailers that get impacted by that, but a lot of small local retailers as well. And that has a really negative impact, obviously, upon the industry and upon public safety.
Absolutely. As Trent had said, one of the things we did want to circle back on is inflation. Obviously, it's been a topic on the minds of many retailers. So from your perspective, which retail sectors have seen the more substantial effects from inflation, and how does the inflationary landscape affect shopping centers?
You know, today, the consumer has been exceptionally resilient. And so you've seen that, you know, in monthly retail sales numbers really over the course of the last year plus, including even in the most recent ones, which weren't as strong as perhaps anticipated, where we're still fairly strong and solid March retail sales. But inflationary pressures, initially, obviously the Fed had hoped that they were transitory in nature. They haven't turned out to be transitory in nature, and inflation's a real risk to the economy for sure. To date, again, the consumer's been resilient, and you know, personal savings rates are high. You have an exceptionally strong job market. So I expect that to continue for a period of time, but you are seeing signs of some discretionary items getting impacted to some extent. And I'll give you an example. In March's retail sales numbers, you saw online sales decrease. And you know, just online purchases tend to be more discretionary than those that you go to the store, which has a higher mix of essential type of retail. So I think you'll potentially see that as an indicator that there is some softening around discretionary items. We recently did a consumer survey, and first and foremost, consumers tend to look at their personal financial situations more than the macroeconomic indicators. And so if they personally feel comfortable, they're going to continue to spend. But they did, you know, identify inflation as their number one item of concern. When they said, what would they cut back on if they chose to cut back on it? Again, we haven't seen it in a large scale yet, but from a level of priority, you know, going out to eat, again, very discretionary in nature. So that could be an indicator, you know, looking forward, if we start to see softening in the food and beverage space. Subscription type services, you know, things like streaming services, et cetera, would be the second thing that they would cut back on. And then of course, travel and entertainment would be the third. And then I think as it relates to retail and product purchases, you know, I think one of the things you'd have to look for are people moving away from, you know, luxury brands or name brands and moving more into off-brand type topics or products. And so those are the things that we'll be looking for. Again, the consumer has been resilient. But, you know, inflation is obviously here. And, you know, our hope would be that the Fed will be able to navigate this into a soft landing. But I think we all have to be, you know, sensitive and cognizant and look at the trends as they exist.
So we've been able to talk about a lot of different things here, both in terms of the upcoming ICSC event in Las Vegas, regulations, inflation, pretty much spanned the gamut. But I'm curious if there's anything that we've kind of left on the table in terms of commercial real estate as a whole, what some other stories or themes are that you feel like will be prevalent in the industry consciousness going forward, not only in 2022, but in the few years beyond.
Well, I think one of the things that when you think real estate, people don't often think of innovation, but I think there's been an awful lot of innovation that's taken place in the industry, particularly in retail real estate. I mean, if you just think of just the acceleration of trends that have taken place over the course of the pandemic, the power of being able to use, you know, your smartphone, placing an order, going into picking it up immediately in a store, or purchasing something, ordering something to eat and showing up at your doorstep, you know, 20 minutes later. All those things are really about convergence and about the convergence of the physical and digital world. And I think that the level of change that's happened in such a short period of time has been tremendous. And not just big businesses, small businesses. You think of that local restaurant that, you know, is now really an omni-channel service provider. And that took place over the course of the pandemic, really on a moment's notice. And I think innovation is something that we will continue to talk about, because you need to change, you need to evolve, and the consumer is changing so rapidly. I think things like the metaverse, obviously new. Technology never steps back. It always moves forward. And so that'll be a conversation that, you know, I think some will have an interest in and will be talked about at ICSC Vegas. And then I mentioned diversity, equity, and inclusion. You know, we're a large industry. We have a lot of progress to make in the DE&I space. And so that will be a big focus of conversation. And ICSC is working with a lot of folks within the industry to really advance DE&I. We're very, very proud of our talent incubator program within our ICSC Foundation. that has a host of different programs related to students and really building the pipeline for the future in our industry. But one particular program that we're super proud about is our Launch Academy, which provides internships for racially diverse students in the industry. Last year, we had 29 students that had paid internships, housing support if they had to move to take that internship. And this year, we're looking to double that and probably will double it. So the topic of DE&I is something that is the industry is super focused on, and ICSC is also super focused on working with the industry to try to lead into the future.
And those topics will certainly be ones we're looking forward to discussing as we at the podcast attend the event. Well, once again, Tom, we appreciate you taking the time joining us today on the podcast, and we're very, very excited to see everyone in person for the first time in a few years this coming May.
Look forward to seeing you there.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Once again, we thank Tom for joining us. It's always great to have him on the show. We talked to him last year as well, and we are looking forward to be on location at ICSC, recording several interviews there that we will run this summer during the course of the show. I also thank McKenna for making her podcast debut, although certainly wish she had her voice with her, but she'll be conducting many of the interviews at ICSC along with me as we go to that particular conference. Now, in our Looking Ahead segment, we're looking at regional grocer Hy-Vee. Hy-Vee, of course, a grocery store that is expanding. They've got over 93,000 employees and more than 285 stores in the upper Midwest. And there's somewhat of an awkward advertorial this week in the Cedar Rapids Gazette that basically claims that a recession is coming, and as such, they are seeking to move employees from their corporate offices into retail store locations. This was, I think, from the outside looking in, kind of an awkward way to announce these changes, because if you read the advertorial, it is very negative regarding the economy of the U.S. So you have these other grocers, you have Albertsons, you have Kroger, you have Walmart talking about the traffic to their stores, talking about how they continue to see customers flowing through the doors, even with food inflation. But this advertorial took on a bit more of a negative slant, and quoting numbers like those from Goldman Sachs that say that there's a 35% chance from a recession in the next 24 months, that many investors feel as though a recession is coming, and as such, they are working to trim back at their corporate locations. They're asking 500 corporate office employees, again, to shift to retail management positions throughout their network of stores. Over 100 of their corporate employees, according to this advertorial, have already taken retail management positions. They're doing this for a few different reasons, but it seems as though the underlying reason here is potentially cost-cutting for Hy-Vee, but of course they're also having issues staffing their retail stores, so attempting to push employees kind of downhill, so to speak, back into those retail stores to help out from a management perspective. The reason I'm looking ahead here is this seems like a bit of an unusual way to first announce this to the public. You would think that a press release maybe that framed it in a more positive light would have been the least the retailer could do. But this advertorial, like I said, it takes a very negative tone about the economy of the United States and about inflationary issues. And you wonder how they communicated it to internal employees as well. Also, from Hy-Vee's perspective, this might result in a lot of these employees kind of seeing the writing on the wall and leaving the company entirely. So you get kind of a brain drain effect as far as these longstanding employees are concerned. Now, of course, 100 employees have already agreed to take those roles in those retail locations, but you just kind of have to wonder about the strength of Hy-Vee, who again has been expanding. They have not slowed their brick and mortar expansion like the likes of Kroger did during the course of the pandemic. And again, because they are a privately held company, we don't know how they're doing financially, but a move such as this and an advertorial such as this suggests that all may not be on the up and up financially for Hy-Vee if they're already looking to cut costs in an area and an atmosphere where we are seeing same store sales for most grocers go up in lockstep with inflation and not fall back behind inflation. So just a bizarre situation overall. And the reason I'm looking ahead to this is if Hy-Vee will maybe curtail their expansion plans in the near future and what will happen to some of these associates, especially a lot of corporate associates. You've got non-compete clauses in there. You wonder if some are going to negotiate to take those out if they take these other roles, or you wonder if some will begin to look for positions at other companies and maybe not in retail entirely. Either way, I don't think this is good news for Hy-Vee. I don't think this portends well for the regional retailer. And it's one that honestly, we feel like, again, not having their financial numbers, they seem to be doing quite well. They are always on point in terms of merchandising, in terms of the overall store feel, in terms of customer sentiment. They are always among the top. They are oftentimes mentioned right there with H-E-B and Publix in terms of America's favorite grocery stores, at least in terms of the regions they do business. But this, again, seems like a negative sign overall for the retailer, and it's certainly something we'll be keeping an eye on as far as the development is concerned. We'll also look towards Kroger, Albertsons, Walmart, and others to see if they happen to make similar moves, bracing themselves for a potential recession in the near future. Well, that'll do it for this week's episode of the Retail Focus Podcast. We thank McKenna Langley, our associate producer, and of course, Layton doing work behind the scenes. No episode next week. I will be traveling. I'm heading to Missouri to MC an event to raise funds for cystic fibrosis research. That's a cause that's near and dear to my heart, so I'm looking forward to that, but it also precludes me from being able to record an interview or the show this coming week. So we will be back on 14 days from now, and we will look forward to meeting with you again then.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.